this is our last class. It is the last two chapters of Voyage of the Dawn Treader, 15 and 16. They have, at some level, fulfilled the promises of the quest. Caspian has now fulfilled his oath that the seven lords, that all of the lords have now been accounted for. And in order to kind of break this sort of sleeping enchantment on the last group of them, they leave Ramandu's island and they sail to the Utter East. They have feasted now at Aslan's table. We've talked about kind of the eschatological symbolism and the Book of Revelation and the wedding supper of the Lamb and the Eucharistic feast and all sorts of amazing things that they have now left behind with Ramandu, who is in actuality what?
Star.
He's a star. In this cosmology, Ramandu is a retired star who, as he is describing it to them, got old beyond reckoning and so was kind of granted this period of rest, but he's being renewed day by day and he's actually getting younger. And this is kind of an amazing place, but in order to make the most of the quest, they are right on the threshold of the very end. They choose to go further, and in order to break the enchantment, one person will have to stay behind. So the thought is, they're going to go to the Utter East. Who wants to stay behind?
Reepicci.
Because remember, from the very beginning, he's had this, first as a lullaby when he was a baby, and now this, it's almost a dream or a vision that's pushing him forward, that what his heart truly desires is to be found in the uttermost east, is to be found in Aslan's country. He desires to be there and to never return. And even though the sailors are sort of initially thinking, well, we've already done what we're supposed to do, we're going to go back, Caspian has this wonderfully kingly moment where he challenges them instead of asks them. He basically says, we're going to go fulfill the final terms of this quest, and if we think you're good enough, maybe we'll take you with us. So instead of having to kind of browbeat them or convince them, he sort of flips the tables on them, and now all these sailors are desperate to go. How many in the very end do not go? Just the one. The one guy who held out at the very end is like, oh, okay, I guess I'll go. And Caspian would say, well, no thanks. If you're the last one, no. You're only coming because you want to be alone? Well, that's not a good enough reason. But even that guy, who gets left alone on the island, eventually he ships off and goes away and kind of makes up this story that he went with them. And in his own kind of sort of sad way, he has a happy ending because he eventually begins to believe his own stories. But they have left now Ramandu's island. They are going to return, is the plan, after finding who knows what will happen in the east. The plan is to leave Reepicci and to come back. What will they do when they get back to Ramandu's island?
I don't remember.
Well, they're probably going to pick up those lords who are now awake.
Oh, yeah.
They're
yeah.
assuming these lords will now wake up. And, you know, my guess is they're going to bring them home rather than just leave them at Ramandu's island for no good reason. Caspian has one more reason to go back. What would that be?
The young
daughter.
Yeah, Ramandu's daughter kind of caught his eye, and they had a very... very polite interaction at the end where he said, I would like to come back and see you. So, here's where we are at the very end. They sail off, and it already starts to feel like they are at the end of the world. What are some of the things that are different about where they're sailing right now?
The sun looks so huge.
Yeah, initially, they have felt like the sun was getting bigger and closer, And then by the time they get to Remander's Island, it seems a definite thing. But now as they go past that, it's beyond definite. It's inarguable. It seems two or three times larger.
And the light stays.
And it's always light. They're seeing the birds that are coming from the uttermost east back to Remander's Island to clean the Aslan's table.
Right.
And what's the water like?
Sweet.
It's sweet, but first they notice it's
clear.
It's crystal clear.
Yeah.
To the point where, as Lucy is watching, she thinks there's something underneath them that's dark, and finally realizes the water's so clear she can see the shadow of the boat. You know, however deep down that is. So, you know, waters of the sea aren't that clear. So this is kind of a special, amazing thing. So as they are traveling, and it doesn't even seem to be wind anymore. They're just off they go.
Following the current.
That's right. So what else does Lucy notice other than the clarity of the water?
The sea people.
That's right. First she starts seeing landmarks or sea marks where, you know, evidence of civilization. Something looks kind of like a road or a path. Something that looks like buildings, and they come across something that looks like even a city, and they see these mer people. And how would you describe the mer people?
Well, the first ones were the men that seemed to be like warriors, and I felt like they were very large people on large horses. Maybe, I don't know if they were as large as giants, but they were larger than human.
Right. They were on these big sea horses, and they looked fierce, and they were kind of unhappy at seeing Lucy in the ship.
And they were,
you know, kind of threatening them a little bit. Now, they've never seen a boat before. They've never seen people before. We are so far now to the east. There has been no. And this is kind of a first contact sort of thing. And so they see this huge, troubling thing above them. And so their first response seems to be to, you know, hey, you. And a threat towards the Dawn Treader results in what? Mouse overboard.
Oh, yeah.
Oh.
He went into the water because he was...
As soon as he saw somebody threatening a Dawn Treader, off he went. He jumped right over and he was going to take him on. And as they haul him back up, thinking that he's still sputtering and shouting about his honor being challenged, what do they find out? That's where they find out the water's sweet. Now, I remember as a kid reading this book for the very first time, and I assumed that meant, I kind of have this picture of like water with sugar in it. Mm. Like sweet. Like you could taste sweetness. But why was I incorrect? The water is not sugary sweet. What does it mean?
It's fresh, it's not salty.
It's fresh. Okay, this is an Englishism, this is a Britishism, where sweet water is what we would call fresh water.
Okay.
And I didn't know that. You know, first time I read it, I was kind of thinking like, oh, it's like, this water is so amazing, it actually tastes sweet. But that's, yeah, it's just one of those things that I had to grow up and learn. However, as much as I want to liken this to something like spring water, and I love the springs. I grew up going to Rock Springs and Apopka and going down the tube runs and going up to Fort White and doing the Itchitepny. And I mean, I love the cool, clear water, but this water seems to be even beyond that. What are some of the things about this water that seems so remarkable?
I know it was so clear that they could see to the very bottom. They could see everything that was in the, even though it appeared not to be that far down, it was a long ways down. And it didn't.
What happens when they drink it?
I don't remember.
Oh.
Something happens to them when they drink it. They describe it as though it were liquid light. Even drinking this water seems to change them. They don't need to eat so much. They don't need to sleep so much. Even the light getting closer and closer to the sun, which used to be unbearable, now doesn't bother them at all. It's almost like they're more alert. They're more alive. They're almost radiant in drinking in this water as though it were liquid light. How does all that strike you?
It's holy water.
I think, you know,
this whole chapter somehow.
It's just very, very beautiful to me. And the holiness that exudes even from the natural order. As they approach Aslan's country, which is basically heaven, that they're in kind of a borderlands where even the earthly things start becoming kind of heavenly. And I'll tell you what I think of. I think of the Great Divorce. When the ghosts come to the edge of heaven from hell, remember what happens when the ghost starts stepping on the grass? It hurts. It's too hard. It's like stepping on sharp diamonds. And it's not because the grass itself is actually hard and sharp. They are personally so insubstantial that in the heavenly country, they, as ghosts from hell or purgatory or whatever it's going to wind up being as an end result, they are somehow less real. And the grass in heaven is more real than even earthly grass. And that's why it's like diamonds and it's cutting their feet. And the only way they can stay is for them to become more solid. And I almost see parallels in this. They are not prepared for the heavenly country. It would overwhelm their human senses. Just like it's too much light from the close-by sun. But now as they start to drink this almost heavenly holy water, this liquid light, they are slowly being transformed so that they are almost more real. This water is not less real, it's more real than the waters they've encountered before. There's more life in this water. This, you know, living waters that come from a limitless fountain that quench our spirits and our souls. I mean, this is very, very theological. This is very heavenly oriented. That they're drinking water and it's changing their lives. They're brighter, they're stronger, they're more awake, they're more alert, they're more at peace. To the point where they don't even need to eat anymore.
That's what
they weren't talking to each other.
And they didn't need to. They kind of just, there's almost like this is communion. You know, this is a sideways story. But I remember as a teenager, my dad used to drive me to high school. He would drop me off, and then he would drive off to where he taught. It was kind of far away, but it was a little bit on the way. But this was very clearly doing it, you know, to bless me. And I remember him getting frustrated at me once because I wasn't talking to him. And, you know, like, he was sort of accusing me of being a sullen teenager, that kind of thing. And I was kind of taken aback. And so I was just honest with him that I didn't feel that way at all. I really liked this. I was really happy he was doing it because, I mean, I knew it was a favor. But I just like kind of being with him. And it just didn't sort of feel like I had anything to say. Not because I don't want to talk to you, but I was enjoying just being here next to you and knowing every day you were going out of your way to do this for me. And I think he was a little taken aback by that. And so we all kind of worked it out. But aren't there times where you have felt so close to someone that you just don't need to say something? It just kind of, even just being next to them quietly feels very, very intimate. And I kind of see communion here. Like communion, not just receiving the body and the blood, but communion in its fuller sense of this is how we are united by the body of Christ. So at peace in him and with each other, we don't even have to talk. I can be next to you and just be at peace, and together we are just in joy. So.
Rinpoche gets in on this as usual.
All right, what happens?
They're talking about getting to the end of the world and being poured over it.
Right, yeah, what happens if it's like a table and the water just kind of falls like a waterfall continually? And Rinpoche thinks that'd be awesome. I will happily, you know, go right over the edge. And how cool would it be to see what the edge looks like before you plummet to your death?
The ship will tip up, stand on her head for one moment, we'll see the edge and go down.
Yeah, and he's like, yeah, that's totally worth it to me. Yeah, thanks for that. So, it was, it's just a beautiful chapter, just a beautiful chapter. Now, at the end, at the very end of the chapter at least, Edmund and Caspian, well, Eustace probably starts it, but they start talking about the nature of the world. You know, because when they lay out that kind of table thing, and what is Eustace?
He's got to straighten them out.
He's got to straighten them out.
It's round.
It's that we come from a round world. And Edmund goes, yeah, it's true. So how does that strike Caspian? Do you remember? It's just a funny little thing at the end. He thought that was awesome. Oh, how great would it be to live in a round world? Have you ever gotten the chance to go to the end of the world where people are walking upside down? That would be so great. And Edmund's like, actually, it's, you know what? It's way less interesting than you think. But it's kind of, you know, it's just, it's sort of funny with these different assumptions.
I agree with you. I thought that chapter was so good.
Just beautiful.
It was best.
So, we now arrive to the very end. And while this seems like a bit of an aside, I think it is a worthwhile aside to catch this only paragraph long story between Lucy and a mermaid girl. What happens?
Well, they look into each other's eyes and there's instant love, and they know that they never touch, mm-hmm. but they just know that if they ever come in contact again, it'll be a relationship that just goes on from there and be greater.
And it's just a beautiful little, it's just a little tiny vignette, but so very sweet. And this line, there does not seem to be much chance of their meeting again in that world or any other, but if they ever do, they will rush together with their hands held out. And that nature of friendship and its purity, I just thought was a lovely little aside. There is a way to convey enormous meaning and depth through a very, very short passage or phrase. It's rare and it's tough, but I think he accomplishes it this year. There's almost like a whole novel in a little paragraph. It's your imagination, but the way it's crafted, I think, just kind of opens up into feeling like it's a story, even though it's, you know, it's just a few sentences. The way that it has so much in so little reminds me of a different story. And I don't remember if it was a contest or if it was a challenge, but something like writing the world's shortest novel or whatever it was. And so it was Hemingway. And he wrote simply this. Used baby shoes for sale. never worn. That was his whole story. And it, you know, just, it's, there's two sentences, but everything you need, in essence. So how incredibly moving, even just this little moment between Lucy and a girl that she never actually touches, but a friendship so pure that's kindled that would last beyond the confines of that world. Anyway, they, again, they're so close and they are so nourished by the liquid light. They don't need to eat, they don't need to sleep, they just, it just seems like that they are, they're becoming more and more alive, and yet it feels like they're coming to the end. And so what do they find there right before they can go no further? Something changes in the water.
The lilies.
Lilies. So all of a sudden, even though the water is deep, which should not support,
lilies grow in shallow water.
Yeah, as the roots grow down in the water, they need to be close enough to the ground to still pull nutrients up. And so this water is not, crazy deep, but it's way deeper than you would expect floating flowers. And yet, it's like the sea is white with these blooming flowers.
I found it interesting because lily ponds have a lot of green in them normally, but they don't mention the green.
It's only the blossom. Yeah. Yeah, when they even, kind of get close enough to where they can scoop it up and all that, it just, they're filled with these flowery blossoms. And it's almost like the good part of the lily and not the crummy, slimy part. But maybe isn't that how it, the last sea at the edge of heaven, its beauty is perfected with no drawback, no downside, no dirty part. And when we hear lily, I think we can think of, lilies that grow in ponds, but what else do we think of?
Easter.
There on the border of heaven, as far as you can see, to the point where it makes the sea look silver, which is what they wind up naming it, is the symbol of the resurrection. So they continue through these lilies until what happens?
Until they part.
Well, I mean, the lilies just kind of part for them, but they continue onward until what happened?
I don't know.
Well, they go as far as they can.
Oh, they
the
go
water
around.
Starts to get shallow.
They go around.
The water starts to get shallow,
yeah.
And it gets more and more shallow until finally it just stops. And they can go no further. And so what happens when they can go no further?
Reaper Chief wants to go on by himself.
That's right. This is where the quest should be at an end. We have now come to the uttermost that we can possibly sail. And the promise was, this is where Reaper Chief is going to have that little boat. And he is going to go down. And he will sail as far as he can, and then it's time now for the Dawn Treader to return. But that's not what happens yet. Caspian has changed his mind.
Oh, Caspian's going to stay.
And why is that?
I don't know why.
Richard says
it,
His Majesty cannot.
Right, he's basically said, I want to see
the end.
Therefore, you may now turn around and go back and,
yeah.
and you know, give my regards to everyone back in Narnia and make sure that everyone is compensated well and, you know, feel free to choose a new king in whatever way seems fit. And how does the crew take that?
No way.
No, they're all arguing with him.
Yeah, what the heck?
Yeah.
Are you abdicating? And he's like, well, I'm just going to go to the end. You know, Rika keeps going to the end, so I'm going to the end. You know, I'm the boss, and I get to do what I say. And this is what I want to do. So, what happens then? Well,
Lucy reminds him about his promise, more or less, to the girl.
Well, that's kind of like a final snap him out of it. But what?
Oh.
How does this argument go? Because there's an act there, it gets kind of sharp and pointed here. Caspian, what's Caspian's point of view?
I thought you were all my subjects, and now you're my schoolmasters.
Right. I'm the king, therefore I get to do what I say. And what's their perspective?
It's mutiny.
Edmund tells him he cannot do this, and he says there's can't again. What do you mean?
Right, well, you know, and Edmund, because especially as Caspian gets dismissive and calls them all his subjects, Edmund kind of chimes in, actually, I'm not your subject.
Mm-hmm.
I outrank you,
yeah.
And I'm telling you can't do this. And so I'm gonna say it's not mutiny. It is the fulfillment of the crew's obligation, because Caspian has gotten this back. He is saying, in essence, I'm the king, I get to do what I want. They are reminding him, no, you are the king, you need to do what you must. So it's basically an understanding of regency, of being a king, that says it's about responsibility and duty, it's not about whimsical power. You know, we think king like, oh, wouldn't it be great to be the boss? I can do whatever I want. But that's not the real rationale of being a king. And way back, see, Caspian knows this. Way back in the last book, when Myraz is defeated, and Caspian is still basically a teenager, and a young one at that, and he is asked by Aslan if he thinks he's ready to be a king. And Caspian basically says, I'll try my best, but I don't think I'm ready. And Aslan says, well, good. That's exactly the sort of humility you ought to have. And then he lays out that a king ought to be first in battle and the last to retreat. A king ought to be, when there's a famine, the one who eats the least but looks the happiest. A king ought to lead by example and be a servant. This is a very, very Christian view of the responsibility of power and of the servant nature of authority. You are not the king for your own fulfillment of pleasure. You are the king in order to rule wisely and to serve. And so he's got this all backwards, and it really ticks him off. Does this remind you about any other part of the book? Because it does for me. This nearly same thing happened before.
Well, his uncle.
Well, in this book, there's another chapter where something very similar to this happened. Deathwater. Remember, they realize that this has the power to turn anything to gold, and they almost get into a fight over it. Like, they draw swords, because Caspian sees honor and power through being the king who controls all this gold, and Edmund's like, well, you know, you're no king of mine, and I'm the king of you, and they start really kind of getting at each other. And so, again, this seems to be like a
learning process, growing process.
Almost an enchantment. Like, they kind of don't really know what they're doing, but they get caught up in it.
Yeah.
And I'm not so sure that Caspian is quite this selfish and immature on his own, and maybe he is, but I just think there's something about getting that close, and it drives him just a little bit crazy.
Well, that's kind of what life is like. Lots of times you get, you maybe know, and you're living in that space of humility and growing into something, but then you get kind of on the edge, and all of a sudden you get sucked over the edge, and it goes from humility to ego and power.
It doesn't take much.
And if you don't pay attention to the Lord and get straightened up pretty quickly, you can get into a big bucket of trouble.
So this starts to go south quickly. And like you said, the ego and power just sort of overwhelms him. And it's really Lucy who gets him to calm down, to think about Romandu's daughter. But it's not a good calm down. It's just basically he storms off and slams the door like a petulant teenager. And what has he decided before he storms off? And this is now you know that he's acting like a petulant teenager.
Have your way. We'll return.
All of us.
Yes.
All of us. What does he mean by that?
Even Reepicheep.
Even Reepicheep. Because if I can't go, no one can go. I mean, this is as spoiled as it gets. Where if you can't have what you want, you're going to make sure nobody gets it. And that, as he storms off and slams the door, he has basically told Reepicheep that the entire reason you've come right at the threshold is all for nothing, because I am so maliciously nasty right now, I'm going to snatch it away from you. Well, this would be a horrible way to end such an amazing quest. So what happens next?
Is that when the lamb appears?
Nope. Caspian comes back out, and Caspian has quite changed.
Asim spoke, has spoken to me.
That's right. So in his fit of anger, the petulant teenager has stormed off into his room, and there in the privacy of his room, he has been chastised. So Aslan has spoken to him. He has seen the folly of his ways. He's seen the ugliness of his heart. And he comes back with news. So, what is the news? Well, the news is he's going to do his duty, and he's been chastened, and he has repented. Reepicheep will be able to continue onward to the end, but Edmund, Lucy, and Eustace must accompany him. Their time to go is now.
Mm-hmm.
So the kids kind of all knew that it was they were going to have to go sooner rather than later, but it's still kind of hard, and it's still sort of teary. Caspian, in particular, seems to take it hard. Any thoughts why?
He was very close to all of them,
mm-hmm.
and I don't think he really saw them as subjects. They were companions.
Yeah, these were real friends, mm-hmm. and they had been through a lot together. And so there's a sadness in their parting. I also think this seems like a very real moment to me, for Caspian in particular, right now to be so emotional. Because even though everybody knew at some point they were going to have to say goodbye, for it to be right now, I think it just adds a layer of shame on his behavior just a moment ago. You know, if I knew you were leaving, all those moments would be so precious, and we would just spend it together. And instead, what's the last thing I do? I show my rear end and I act like a jerk. And so I think it's all kind of hitting him at once. There is sadness and there is remorse, maybe all kind of wrapped together. But it's now time. And so they, you know, food and water, they make their goodbyes, and then they lower the coracle down, the ship raises all sails and shields in honor as it begins to sail away. Because it's so shallow, they're able to take the boat for a while. But then they come to the very end. And they see what looks like the edge of a waterfall. It's a wave. Instead of the water going downward, it's going upward. Like a wall of water that they cannot quite see through or past, but they can see what lies above. In the distance, in the horizon, what do they see?
Move.
They see mountains bigger than any mountains on Earth. But it doesn't look like an earthly mountain, because earthly mountains that tall should have snow.
Mm-hmm.
And instead, they can see they're lush and they're green and they're beautiful. No matter how tall they get, they are actually looking on the outskirts of Aslan's country. They are looking on the outskirts of heaven. And so they know that this is the end for them. And there's a beautiful passage, and suddenly there came a breeze from the east, tossing the top of the wave into foamy shapes and ruffling the smooth water all around them. It only lasted for a second or so. What it brought them in that second, none of those three children will ever forget. It brought both a smell and sound, a musical sound. Edmund and Eustace would never talk about it afterward. Lucy would only say, "It would break your heart." "Why?" said I. "Was it so sad?" "No." "Sad?" said Lucy. "No." There is, as Lewis will write in other places, this is Sehnsucht. This is longing for joy. They have had a breeze come from heaven, and it's made a sound, and it's made a smell, and it's filled their heart with the longing for home, for an eternal home. "I've been built for this. I have been built for this." And it would break your heart to hear that sound again, or to think about it, not because it was sad, but because the longing for it is so sharp, and it's so pure, and it's it would bring tears to your eyes because it's so perfect. It's overwhelming.
Can I go back to something for just a second?
Yeah.
In another book I have been reading, it was pointed out that this kept happening, and this interested me when I read this. All that night and all the next day they glided eastward, and when the third day dawned, the book was talking about it so often, it was the third day.
Yeah, I didn't even notice that. But you're absolutely right. You're absolutely right on the third day. So.
Is that feeling the same as during our life? There are periods where we're close to God, but we just crave being closer to Him? Or is that more to what is experienced at the end of life?
You are right. When you get close, there's this yearning and longing for more. What he will talk about is this sense of longing that we can't quite put our finger on. We have been built for it, but we can't quite. It's like when you have something on the tip of your tongue and you just can't quite figure out what it is. So here's the quote. This is one of his more famous passages, and it's quite powerful in trying to describe this sense of longing, which he says is joy. So, in speaking of this desire for our own far-off country, which we find ourselves in even now, I feel a certain shyness. I feel as if I'm committing an indecency. I'm trying to rip open the inconsolable secret in each of you, the secret which hurts so much that you take your revenge on it by calling it names like nostalgia and romanticism and adolescence, the secret which pierces with such sweetness that when in very intimate conversation the mention of it becomes imminent, we grow awkward and affect to laugh at ourselves, the secret we cannot hide and cannot tell, though we desire to do both. We cannot tell it because it is a desire for something that has never actually appeared in our experience. We cannot hide it because our experience is constantly suggesting it. And we betray ourselves like lovers at the mention of a name. Our commonest experience is to call it beauty and behave as if that had settled the matter. The books are music in which we thought the beauty was located will betray us if we trusted them. It was not in them. It only came through them. What came through them was longing. These things, the beauty, the memory of our own past, are good images of what we really desire. But if they are mistaken for the real thing, they turn into dumb idols, breaking the hearts of their worshipers, for they are not the thing itself. They are only the scent of a flower we have not found, the echo of a tune we have not heard, news from a country we have never yet visited. The good things of this life that make us feel so happy, even in fleeting moments, he's saying, are actually like the barest glimpse of heavenly joy. And the reason we want them and we long for them, we desire them, whatever makes us happy, we want more of it, is because we long for heaven. We have been built. This is Augustine, you know, my soul is restless until it finds its rest in thee. We have been built for fellowship with God. And the good things of this life that touch that longing or prick that longing or give us a glimpse of that longing, we identify as beauty or joy or love or happiness or whatever, but the reason we like them is because not the thing itself, it's because it's connecting us to what we've truly been built for.
So it could be either.
It is. And I think you're right on it. You know, the closer we get, the more our hearts desire. And we know that in our lives. We know that in romance. You know, the more you fall in love with someone, the more you want to love them, the more you want to be with them, the more you're with them, the more you want them even more. But we know this in subjects we're interested in. We know this in achievements we strive to achieve. And this, but all of these things he's suggesting are actually pointing to some, they are good, but they're actually pointing to a good even deeper.
Can't quite get there.
That's right. Not yet. So we appreciate the good gifts, but it's really the gift giver through whom this love is received. So that's where we are with this. They know now. They are at the true edge and looking over into Aslan's country. And what does that do for Reaper Sheep?
Thank you.
Well, he just knows. This is it. This is where I leave. And Lewis has a way of wrapping up some of these stories that just kind of, not only so satisfying, like a deep satisfying, but even as I come across some of these phrases, it almost makes the hair on my arms stand up. As Reepicheep knows it's time, and he lowers his little boat, what's the first thing he does?
Throws his sword.
He gives away his
sword.
Shall need it no more. For in Aslan's country, there is no more need for a sword. And this was the guy who, if there was ever even the slightest hint of needing a sword, he was the first one to pull it out and jump. And now the chivalrous holy knight has truly come to the end of his quest. It's never been about the fighting. The fighting has always been a means to an end. Honor and integrity and service. And now, he is at the end. So the tools of the trade are no longer necessary. You don't have to be a fighter anymore. Mm-hmm. Now you have truly come to peace. Lucy snatches him up and snuggles him like she's always wanted to do. And it's just, you know, it's right and it's good. And so how does the story of Reepicheep conclude?
They saw its shape. Oracle and Reepicheep at the very top, and it vanished.
So he actually takes this boat up the wave, up the waterfall, right to the tippy top, and then they don't see him again.
Safe in Aslan's country, alive there today.
And so the kids are now alone, and they just sort of walk, and they just sort of spend that quiet time of fellowship together, not exactly sure what's going to happen next, and who do they meet?
The lamb.
The lamb. And the lamb invites them to eat. What do they eat?
Breakfast.
It's breakfast, but I think there's a purpose.
Fish. Oh.
There's a purpose. What's the purpose in that? Why make note that it's fish? Not just because they're on the sea.
Well, I know what I thought of.
What did you think of?
Jesus cooking the fish for the apostles.
That's exactly right. After the resurrection,
yeah.
Jesus cooks breakfast. And this is one of the demonstrations of the resurrection, that he's not a ghost or a spirit. He eats fish with them. He cooks and they eat. And so, in this sort of parallel moment, and the lamb says, this is not the way for you to get into Aslan's country. How are they supposed to get into Aslan's country?
In their own life.
Through their own world and in their own life. And as he speaks this, what happens to the lamb? They now see him differently. What does he look like now?
As Aslan.
That's right. So the lamb, who is also the lion, and the lion, who is also the lamb. Will you tell us how to get into your country? I shall be telling you all the time, said Aslan. And though there is a gulf affixed, he is the great bridge builder. He is the pontiff. And will we be able to go back? And what does Aslan tell them?
We'll open the door in the sky and be sent to your own land.
But when can we come back? Lucy wants to know. Please, please, please. And Aslan tells them what?
You're too old.
He says, you're not coming back. You are too old. You are too old. Now, this may be the most important paragraph of all seven books. Do not gloss over it, but allow it to linger. Because Lucy is desperately sad in hearing that she will not return. She says, it isn't Narnia, you know. It's you. We shan't meet you there, and how can we live never meeting you? But you shall meet me, dear ones, said Aslan. Are you there too, sir, said Edmund? I am, said Aslan. But there I have another name. You must learn to know me by that name. This was the very reason why you were brought to Narnia, that by knowing me here for a little, you may know me better there. So in that one little paragraph, he basically explains all of the purpose and the rationale for all of these books and all of this story. It's so they would know Jesus. Now, what about Eustace? Is he allowed to come back?
Yeah.
Well, he just basically says, do you really need to know that? Once again, it's not your story, it's his. So like the rending of a blue wall or a curtain being torn. More biblical imagery, just for good measure. They feel his mane and they feel his kiss upon their foreheads. And there they are, no longer at the utter edge of Aslan's country, but they are where?
Back in their room, in the bedroom.
Back in Aunt Alberta's house in Cambridge. So we wrap up with Caspian, they get back to Romandu's Island. Everyone is safe and sound. The three lords were awake. What happened with Caspian also?
Married Romandu's
daughter. He marries the daughter of the star. She becomes a great queen. And there are more stories to be told. But what about Eustace? You never know, he was the same kid. I wonder what happened. And everyone seemed very impressed. Except for who?
Aunt Alberta.
His mother. His mother's just kind of annoyed. Because now he just seems so ordinary. And so commonplace. It must have been the influence of those Pevensey children.